This is a special edition of Commodity Week.
Todd Gleason services are made available to WILL by University of Illinois Extension.
Welcome to Commodity Week. I am Todd Gleason. Today, we'll return to the Farm Assets Conference held the 13th day of December in Champaign at the iHotel, where our panel of analysts for the Outlook program included Joe Jansen, University of Illinois agricultural economist, Matt Bennett from AgMarket.net, Brian Stark of the Andersons, and Colin Waters of the Illinois Corn Growers Association. We'll begin with Joe Jansen. He laid out what the current supply and demand situation looked like and some outlook for the 2025 growing season.
Yeah, I'll try and set the table briefly. I know we're at the end of a long day. I appreciate you all being here. At the end of all of this, we get down to kind of brass tacks, which is just what's the price of corn and beans? And those two numbers kind of really make the world go round in this part of the world. So we're going to sort of talk a little bit about what's been happening in corn and bean markets and kind of both on the old crop and new crop side, where we think things, how things sort of set up as we move into 2025. So I was just making this point to Brian just a second ago. The good news is on this slide. It's kind of hard to see. But we've kind of, after a period of declining prices for both corn and soybeans, the good news is we've got back to something that's better than we've seen, which is $4.50 corn on the board. The March 2025 corn contract now is right around, or maybe today just a little bit less than $4.50 a bushel. That's the good news, which means that there's maybe not a ton of good news in this picture. The other on the bean side, the current nearby soybean futures price right around $10 a bushel. That's sort of setting up to say that beans have kind of hung in there pretty well given a lot of bearish news I've seen. So the big driver here, obviously, in the last year has been the big crop that we harvested this last year in the United States, coming on the back of relatively good production out of South America. Joanna Calusi, my colleague, talked a bunch about that already, so I won't delve too deeply into that. But what is this? I think it's really Matt and I have been up on this panel for a couple of years now, talking about how this is where we tend to go in these markets, is towards kind of these long run lower price levels. You say $10 corn for $10 soybeans and $4 corn is kind of long run ballpark numbers where this market tends to hang out when it's reasonably well supplied, and I think that's the state that we exist in now. I do want to talk a little bit about what this means for marketing, say old crop corn and soybeans. Just thinking a little bit about what the market is offering in terms of pricing grain now versus pricing grain later in this marketing year before we get to that next harvest. So this just shows futures carry, the difference between summertime futures and the nearby March futures for both beans and corn. The market offering a pretty reasonable amount of carry, 21 cents per bushel to carry grain between March and July. The carries in the corn market, there was maybe some opportunity to market grain for delivery later in the year, and the market has really said, we're prioritizing moving some of this grain to market now, and I think that's on the basis of a lot of the export business that we've seen on the corn side, particularly moving corn to parts of Latin America, and we'll talk about what's been developing there. But that's sort of the state of play, how we've got to where we're at. As we go forward, the biggest thing, the biggest unknowns, I think, are on the usage side, in terms of old crop corn and soybeans. How does that demand picture play out as we go through the second half of the marketing year here, going into 2025? And it's important to keep things sort of in proportion. How big are the sort of three big pieces of demand for both corn and beans? I think I sort of break this down as kind of a three-legged stool upon which all of our demand picture stands. One piece being biofuels, that's the dark red slices of these pies. The second piece being domestic feed demand, the green slices. For corn, that's what's labeled as feed. For soybeans, what we think of as domestic meal production, much of which, not all of which, but a significant portion of which is being fed to livestock here in the United States. And then the yellow slices being exports. I'm going to spend, I think, probably most of the limited time that I'm going to take talking about that export piece, in part because the other big pieces tend to be relatively stable year over year. And when we get into a period like we're in right now, where prices are slightly lower, it's that export piece that really is the slack adjuster in sort of the global supply and demand system. Even though exports is a relatively limited share for corn, it's significant enough that it's going to have to pick up some of the slack. When we get down into low prices, we've got to kind of bring some of that export demand to kind of stop this thing from going lower. And so what's going on in export markets is really key as we go forward through the rest of this marketing year. I'll only briefly kind of cover, I've kind of simplified USDA's U.S. corn supply and demand balance sheet here. A couple of key numbers that we think of sort of going forward. The biggest ones being on the usage side, USDA upped their estimates for corn usage for both ethanol and exports on Tuesday in the latest WASDE report. That kind of reverses a situation that we were thinking of where we were going to be in yet another year of building stocks. So you can see at the bottom of this table, stocks to use 2 years ago being under that 10% percent level, which we tend to think of as kind of a pretty significant threshold in terms of being the difference between being in kind of a high and volatile price period versus low and stable prices. We kind of crossed that threshold in 22-23. In 23-24, moving to an 11.8% stocks-to-use ratio. We thought we were going to kind of keep building stocks, but this latest news about usage, primarily on the export side, where USDA upped their export number by about 150 bushels per acre, kind of puts us in a situation where we're actually going to maybe draw down stocks a little bit relative to use. So, you know, 1.7 billion bushel carryout for this current marketing year of 2024-25. But everything indicates that we will see a continued stocks build in 2025-26. So we might talk a little bit, and I think the panel will have thoughts on planted acreage and yield in 25-26. USDA's now slightly dated estimates from their October baseline put corn acres already at 92 million acres. So USDA already thought we're going to plant more corn acres going into 25. The question is sort of, I think everyone in the trade believes that number is going to be significant. It's going to be somewhat higher. It's just a matter of how much. Already, we're kind of factoring in a supply build and a lot of headwinds, particularly on the export piece. So next year's projections for exports, USDA had them at 2.275 billion bushels. That's now 200 million bushels below what we would have been at this year. Obviously, there's a tremendous amount of volatility and variance in what you think might happen with the export picture for U.S. corn going forward. On the soybean side, what does that all mean? You know, the soybean balance sheet tends to have, you know, strong sort of correlation, both in terms of, you know, when U.S. soybean exports are competitive, it doesn't, you know, it stands to reason that when corn exports are competitive, soybean exports are going to be competitive too. When we have a big corn crop, we tend to have a big soybean crop because weather is correlated over space. We expect to see, a continued build in ending stocks for soybeans, pushing us across a 10% stocks to use ratio for 24-25. And that only sort of continues to build in 25-26, in part because those higher expected corn acres are going to mean lower bean acres. USDA had 2025 area planted for soybeans at 85 million acres. I think, you know, if you believe the corn number's higher, you conversely might believe that the soybean number is going to be lower. That'll help us with this stocks build, but there is, you know, structural demand for U.S. soybeans, both in terms of the build in domestic crush that we've seen. USDA is projecting sort of a continued growth in domestic crush and some, you know, relatively similar levels for exports. Both of those things are bearish for the soybean market going forward. So that kind of sets us up sort of some of the big things that we might discuss. I think what we need to sort of see, we've already sort of seen a kind of a corroboration of the idea that U.S. export demand, particularly for corn, is strong for the remainder of this marketing year. There was a thought that a lot of that business was front-loaded, in part because of fears about the imposition of tariffs under a new Trump administration. I think that picture is, if anything, much more uncertain as we go through sort of the latter half of this marketing year. So I have one more slide here on sort of new crop price ratio. This is sort of, again, corroborating this idea of where do we go with planted acres. We're going to swing back towards corn. The question is maybe how much, and I think the panel will each panelist will have thoughts on that in terms of our discussion. I will pass the baton then to...
You're going to pass it down to Matt, and I will take care of him getting started. Matt, you can go ahead and pass the baton or the clicker down to Matt. Matt Bennett, of course, is with AgMarket.net. I talk to him every Thursday afternoon on the closing market report. Thank you, Matt, for doing that for many years now. I appreciate that much and have truly been very happy to watch you and everything you do grow over time. What do you see in your outlook for the marketplace?
Similar to Joe, I was able to see Joe's slides ahead of time, so I figured I wouldn't be quite as bearish as Joe maybe, but I'll let you see my first slide, see if you like this slide. I don't know. If you've got a hedge account, you probably get this if you've ever been through a USDA report, but let's talk about the value of the real versus the dollar. I mean, in essence, right now it's a 22-year low, and so what's that mean? That means that when they have available supplies, they are going to have cheaper supply on the market. Bottom line is, if Brazil has the kind of crop that is projected right now, you could be looking at a pretty big situation as far as the transition from us being heavy on exports, you know, to really subsiding. Now, typically, when you get into February, you start to lose bean exports. It's just the way it goes. But at the same time, this year might even be a little more extreme. We don't know what's going to happen with the tariff situation, of course, but this value of the real versus the dollar is something that you have to keep a very close eye on, because high dollar definitely keeps our products fairly expensive. You know, don't even try to read this, but I went through an exercise. So this is my supply and demand balance sheet that I developed with my team, and this is used whenever we try to forecast what all the numbers will be for these USDA reports. And so I'll just tell you what I did. I at the far right, I've got the 1.737 carryout, 1.738. And then the next column to the left, I actually pushed exports up to $2.5 billion, because there's some people in the industry talking $2.5 billion. And of course, that's going to only draw you down around 25 million bushels. I kept everything else the same. But on the next one to the left, I take yield down to 182. You know, why would I take yield down to 182? Yeah, I don't know what we're going to say in January, but I do think that the dry August did a couple of things. Of course, in places that you didn't get rain, it robbed some bushels, but it also robbed moisture content. And so I had growers sending me from Nebraska and Iowa and Kansas harvesting 12 and 11.5% corn. And I think that that will factor in when you've got people like one of my customers in Nebraska that said he didn't see anything over 12% for a whole week of harvest. So if I do that in my balance sheet, it gets me down to a 1.621 billion bushel carry. And what I'm going to tell you is that I see that similar to this week. You drop 200 million bushels on the December report. That's abnormal. That's not something you typically see. USDA takes it off as far as December is concerned. The market goes up 7 cents on Tuesday and it's gone by Friday. Why is that? It's because it's still 1.738. And unfortunately, you've still got a lot of corn on hand. I'm not saying the corn market can't rally, but two things are really working against the corn market: stocks in the bean market. And so bottom line is, we've got some work ahead of us. Whenever I look at, you know, the stocks and stocks to use ratio, the one thing I'll say, and I kind of put this on here, and I know Joe would agree that we still have a lot of corn, but whenever you look at world stocks to use ratio, we continue to see a drawdown of world stocks. Now, we still have a lot of corn, don't get me wrong, but a drawdown on the stocks-to-use ratio is something that's supportive towards prices at some point. Now, there's a lot of other factors involved, but don't kid yourself. When you looked at the world balance sheet this week, and we're going down 19.8 million metric tons from one marketing year to the next, or 19.6, whatever it was. The other one's 19.8. It's because usage is going up the same amount. And so we have taken usage, and we've really used a whole lot more corn in the world here over the last year, which is a really good thing. Now, one reason why I think the yield could go down, if you look at the ears per acre versus bushels per acre in the November report, one of these 5 years or 6 years, whatever we've got here, six, stands out, doesn't it? And so I'm thinking maybe you do get a little bit of a drop in yield in January. Now, you might say, hey, if we do that, we're really going to go. Guys, we just took 200 out of the balance sheet. If you get rallies, we've got to respect those rallies, because as we've seen this week, they're not long-lived. I'm just going to say, you know, if you go back, and Joe had something similar, if you go back to 2023, 21 and 22 for most of us that are producers made more money in those two back-to-back years than we've ever made in our career. And so we had big corn acres in 23, go figure. We kind of come back a little bit, obviously, as profitability fades. I think your corn to beans to corn guys are going to stay the same. The only reason I think corn acres don't get excessively high is because I do think liquidity is going to come into play whenever it comes to acreage mix. I think some folks will have to plant some soybeans. So I'm right now, I think you go back to a similar acreage as you had a couple years ago. But one thing I'll say on acres, I feel strongly that the corn and soybeans combined are going to come down. Why? Because of profitability. And sometimes you see acres vanish whenever you get into that. The only reason why I throw the chart up there is to show you this yellow line going across here, the 200-day moving average. We've only traded at or above it about 6 days since October of 23. It's been nothing but a brick wall. And so the market went up there. It tested the 200-day moving average this week. And a lot of growers said, you think we should sell some 450 corn? Well, I don't know. Your cash price is 60 cents above what it was in the middle of harvest. You know, I mean, how many of you get bullish whenever the market goes up? Freaking liars. Come on. We get bullish when the market goes up. And so what we've got to understand is that not only have you seen the market come to you, you've seen the basis come to you. And when that happens, an incremental sale, if you ignore it, a rally is not a rally unless you reward it. Was it fun? Yeah, maybe you're in a better mood for a few days. But sometimes you got to think about selling something. Soybeans. The trend of higher stocks, both in the U.S. and world, continues, and the world stocks is likely to be the largest stocks we've ever seen, and there's a very good chance that the stocks-to-use ratio will be the largest stocks-to-use ratio we've ever seen. And so what do we think price action might look like? Obviously not great. You look at South American production over the last 15 years, and it's skyrocketed over 100 million tons higher. And so clearly you've seen just a magnificent increase, you know, in production, and so the Brazilian grower is not going to slow down on expansion. They're just not. Maybe it's going to go below 2% expansion. There's still a lot of acres to expand. And this is what's happening due to that expansion, is that we are losing our world market share as far as exports are concerned. And so when we look at South America versus the U.S. right now, we're looking at about a 3-to-1 ratio. Could we get some more exports? Absolutely. But at the same time, guys, China has invested billions and to try to develop the most efficient way to get soybeans out of Brazil. And clearly, they're going to try to take corn out of Brazil as well at some point. So there's your soybean chart. The only reason I put that up there is just to show you that this bean market over the course of the last few weeks has been in as tight a range as I can remember. The bean market can't get anything put together. And today, of course, the market was lower. You break 975 on front month futures and there's nothing beneath you. So I would be cautious as to assume just because bean prices stink that they can't get worse. And I know that doesn't sound like much fun to talk about. I'm just talking some truth here. If the bean market's going to rally, you absolutely have to have a South American weather issue, and there's just not one right now. So that's all I've got, Todd.
Hey, I've got a quick question before we move on.
Okay.
Related to your farmers in Nebraska with the week-long really low moisture content, when it came back, how much did their yields come back? And I'm trying to get at whether they just had yields that were lower because it was a later crop, and it was exacerbated by the dryness, and or did yields actually come back up to where they were previously?
Most people were not saying that yields came back up. In fact, some of them were able to harvest whenever they had 25% corn. We're talking about a yield drop of 15 bushels. And so, yes. And so test weight was obviously good with 12% corn, right? But you're selling total pounds. That's the problem. And when we let ourselves get, this year was tough, guys. I'm not going to fool you. You guys know that. We were cutting some 9% beans. When we were cutting beans and they had leaves on them, they were 12 and a half, and I knew we were in trouble. And so this year was a very tough year to try to time this. But the bottom line is you're going to lose bushels whenever you get below 15%.
Yeah, the reason I ask, and Brian Stark, you can pick up with your comments here, but the reason I asked that question on the follow-up was because USDA, NASS, unlike the surveys that they'll be getting back from the farmers who probably will account for those lower yields at the very low moisture contents, USDA, NASS will adjust, just probably like Brian does at the elevator, so he'll adjust that back up as a he's going to put the shrink back in.
Sure.
Yeah, right? You're going to adjust it back up, aren't you, right? Is the yield loss or is it just the water that disappeared?
It's the water that disappeared.
That's right. What I thought.
That's right. Water that disappeared. No, I think Matt and Joe have done a good job laying the groundwork. I think, though, maybe I take the contrarian view to end the day on a positive note. We all heard Eric Snodgrass say this morning that we have a 60% chance of a drought this coming year, right? Yes?
That's the positive.
Okay, so let me remind you, hope is not a trading strategy. Okay? So we're in the business of risk management. And yes, I think if you look at any commodity today, in my opinion, that potentially has upside, it is corn, because there is some uncertainty. The government sure threw a curveball this past week with 150 million bushel export increase. Most people that we talked to were expecting maybe a 50 million bushel increase. Think the ethanol 50 million bushel increase was accurate. So that's the curveball. Normally you get those surprises in the January crop report, and we probably still do with yield. You got stocks, quarterly stocks. You got wheat acreage intention seeding. So that report's probably still volatile. But nonetheless, it gave us an opportunity to reach that 200-day moving average Matt was showing you to take advantage of some sales, because the one thing that's been an outlook and positive since harvest ended earlier for most people around Halloween, and typically we see that lag in the middle of November, the end user has been clamoring for corn, right? The basis has been screaming high. We're 40, 50 cents off our lows because that pipeline dried up. Bend doors lock. So why do you think the other thing that is noticeable is the spread action? Matt also and Joe showed that. Spreads have compressed. What I find interesting is that the carryout, even with the demand increase this past week, we are now at the same point as we were this time last year. A 1.7 billion bushel carryout, right? Carries were much wider a year ago. So what does that tell you? Potentially the market's a lot tighter. Maybe we're more front-loaded with demand. Either way, we need to take advantage of manage our risk. We're still in a marketplace, to Joe's point, that we're not below 10% stocks to use. Historically, that's where prices get more volatile. So we have to take the sell and defend approach. So if you're, local basis market strong, take advantage of it. Obviously when the market gives us a rally up into tech resistance, take advantage of it. If there's an opportunity to replace it later on with some sort of upside strategy, that's the best way to approach it rather than staying low in the cash. Because in our game, as we heard earlier from Gary, our returns don't look as bright from a cost structure standpoint. So we are still in an environment where we have to sell and defend. And those are some of the comments that I wanted to highlight after the guys did a great job showing some of our current scenarios. I personally am not as high as Matt on corn acres. I think we're probably going to be in the 93, maybe 93 and a half million acreage range. I am agreeing with them that you will see some phantom acreage loss when you tend to see in lower return environments, acreage tends to disappear. But all in all, I think corn is the commodity that potentially has the most upside. Beans scare me to death. The uncertainty with the unknown of the 45Z tax credit, what that means for soybean oil as far as renewable diesel, I think that's unknown. Plus, what do you do with the meal? I talk to crushers. They're concerned about Q1 crush margins. So I think basis, strength in bidding up for beans when the board stagnates
is not as positive of an outlook as we've seen on the corn front the last 30 to 60 days. So the bean marketing is going to be really troublesome. Even if you see a reduction in acres with the way Brazil and Argentina's crop is progressing, I really think the bean market potentially could be a dead weight on any upside in corn, and you could see a bean price in the low nines at some point. So we have to really be diligent. If producers ask what the biggest commodity is at risk on old crop right now, it's soybeans.
Brian Stark is with the Andersons. He manages facilities both here in Illinois and Indiana, including Logansport, which is an ethanol plant in Indiana. Colin Waters is with us as well. He's at the Illinois Corn Growers Association. Colin, if you use the clicker, your slide is up next.
So I guess one of the things that I think Joe might have mentioned earlier was just about the the export sales, and how a lot of folks might have seen this as kind of a, getting ahead of, potential tariffs and so forth. But all those, that real uptick in sales occurred in October. So that was pre-election, right? So I think that the sales were, the tariff threat was probably a component there, but it wasn't the whole story. But basically, if we just draw a line from where we're at today to the 63 million tons, 2.5 billion bushel number, that's kind of where we're at. So if we just kind of keep our normal pace, we'll hit that target. I'm cautiously optimistic that that's going to happen. Obviously, the story in Brazil is going to really kind of play into this here later on, and I guess the other thing that I was just going to mention is regarding exports is really coming back to kind of the politics of trade. Our top export markets, whether it's the in grain, fuel ethanol, or distillers, our top markets are mainly with countries that we run a trade deficit with, right? And so the incoming administration is really kind of put a it's crosshairs on just about any country that we run a deficit with, where there's probably going to be something happening, right? And so Mexico, Canada have been called out explicitly so far. There's been talk about a 25% tariff day one, the end of January. If that actually happens, I think I'd be a little bit surprised, but the saber rattling's kind of expanded now. There was some almost like schoolyard taunting about the president of Canada could just be Governor Trudeau or whatever. That really pissed off the Canadians, and that doesn't happen, right? The Canadians are just the nicest people on the planet. These guys are angry. Ontario's talking about cutting off energy supplies, stuff like that. It's getting it's getting interesting. Right, so really, our top markets are kind of in the new administration's sights, and the only country that we run a trade surplus with is the United Kingdom, and they are our second largest ethanol market, which isn't really all that big, to be honest. The Canadians dominate the ethanol export market, just like the Mexicans dominate the corn market. You can't replace Mexican demand. That they're 18 million metric tons, close to 20 million metric tons. I think that they're up just so this year they're up 12% over last year, and that was a record last year. It was a big year. So I think that there's some reason to be wary, I suppose, on the export side. So I think that there's a healthy dose of pessimism in the trade space, even though it looks like it should be what could really carry the corn market ahead. And this is definitely an eye chart for folks in the back of the room, but this is just kind of an illustration of where the ethanol export situation is today. So on the far left there, you can see Canada. It's dominant. Recently, the Indians have been buying ethanol, but that's a industrial grade ethanol. It's supposed to be not for use in fuel, but we don't know exactly where that ends up. And then by comparison, you can see the United Kingdom there. It's really, really small. But the diamond shapes there, or points, that's the potential market, right? A lot of these markets are importing ethanol to meet their Paris Accord climate targets or whatever else. It's primarily driven by policy, by fuel policy. And so, just as an example, Canada, we are basically the top supplier of ethanol to Canada, but we're kind of bumping up against that the maximum. The same thing in the UK. South Korea, we could do more, but really South Korea is more of a transshipment hub. But there's other markets like India that are just huge. The Indians are trying to implement an E20 blend, and that, if and when that happens, I think I'm fairly bullish on this, that when that happens, chances are they're going to want to build their own ethanol plants. So it'll probably open up to be a good corn market for the U.S., hopefully. But there's other markets like Nigeria. It's a huge petroleum producer, but it's also a big petroleum consumer. We barely scratched the surface there. I think that's potentially really, really positive. And then Japan, that's another one where it recent changes just in the last 3 to 4 years have just been astounding, actually. Because just a few years ago, if you would have talked about direct blending ethanol into the Japanese fuel supply, the government officials would have just kind of showed you the door. They didn't want to even talk about it. But over the past 3 years, things have really changed. Now they have an E10. So just so you know, they basically have very little direct blending of ethanol in the marketplace. It's a, you know, there's only a handful of stations that supply an E7 blend. There's more that would supply an E3 blend, but they have a target now for an E10 kind of baseline by 2030, and an E20 baseline by 2040. And this is the kind of stuff that, you know, we can't get our own government to do, but the Japanese are kind of taking it all on. And in this kind of, you know, 2040 target, that'll require changes in it from the automakers. They're going to be developing, you know, new engines, higher compression engines to take advantage of that, you know, additional octane. So I guess maybe that's, you know, with my healthy dose of pessimism, I think that there is a lot of there's a lot of positive movements happening in the export space, and we're certainly pushing for that, you know, as opposed to Gary and Nick just wishing all the bad stuff on Brazil. I think that we can expand our markets a little bit more. There's still room. Yeah.
So repeat that question.
So the question is how are all of those policies contingent on basically, well, greenhouse gas scoring? Is that kind of it? So yeah, the answer is, the short version is yes. Pretty much every country will have its own version of a carbon intensity model. So yeah, everybody's different. But that actually has a, that's at least what happened in Japan. That's where a lot of the work that we've been doing has been taking place over the last 5 years, is helping them update their models. A lot of these models, including the EPA models, just so we all know, this isn't just like a, you know, foreign countries kind of dragging their feet. Our own our own regulators have a bad tendency to do this too. Some of those models were relying on data from the early 2000s. It's completely outdated in terms of yields and so forth. And so as we enter this kind of brave new world of carbon intensity, which I genuinely think that farmers are just going to have to, we're all going to have to figure this out together. But this is going to become a bigger and bigger issue. And in I guess hopefully that'll actually drive value and premiums in the marketplace to make it work. But yeah, I don't know. The shortest version is yes. It all depends on some kind of model, and each one of those models has its own, every country has its own fingerprint on that model, and we're all trying to figure it out. And so it's kind of weird. So like you know, in Brazil, traditionally, Brazilian ethanol has always been a lower carbon intensity because it's been primarily sugar cane, right? And that the cane's very, very productive. It just produces a lot of sugar that's easily fermented. But they fire all of those systems with the biomass, the bagasse. But they're all now the Brazilians are producing a lot of corn ethanol. Well, they're able to take advantage of it being a second crop, and therefore, you know, all of the theoretically all of the, you know, carbon intensity could be assigned to the first crop. So if that first crop is soybeans, then it takes all the carbon intensity, and then the second or third crops or whatever else could just be free and clear. This is all kind of theoretical, right? I disagree with that. There's a carbon footprint associated with production of any crop, regardless of how many you can actually get in annually.
Joe, I'd like you to talk in just a moment about the importance of the export market for commodities and what that means for price in general. Why is the export market important, and what does it do on the margin to corn?
On the margin, I tried to maybe make this point and maybe in a too subtle fashion, but it is, when I say it's the slack adjuster, it's the part that's the most price responsive. So when we get prices dipping down, say below, you know, $4 corn, that tends to bring more export business to the market. And that's why that business is so important and why we're talking about it to such a degree. And sort of, it kind of goes to show the sort of like why we're all maybe worried about a tariff situation that we can't really describe or put our hands on, is in part because that tariff might cause that business to dry up pretty quickly. If you look at that list of exporters that Colin showed, I would just point out that, you know, Colombia is number three. That's one of the last nations that we signed a major free trade agreement with, I think back in 2009 or 2010. That's why we did that. It took, you know, a long time, but that business is here. We are somewhat concerned about it. It's something that less maybe in the sort of the old crop 24-25 picture, but going forward into 25-26, you have to be, you know, shading your guess about the export number in part because of the possibility, however remote it might be, that this tariff situation would have, you know, really direct impacts on U.S. export business for corn and soybeans.
And the one thing that I might add to that, sorry, is that, you know, Illinois is half of the corn that's produced in the state leaves the state, and
we're in an unusual position.
So when you look at Joe's, you know, pie chart that shows that 16% or whatever of U.S. corn is exported, well, call it 40% of Illinois corn leaves on barge or rail. Maybe it's not that much, depending on the year, 30 to 40%. It's a big number, right? And so the basis that farmers experience here is very, very different from what you would experience out in maybe the Dakotas or elsewhere, where you don't have the same kind of infrastructure. You don't have the river system to deliver to the Gulf.
There was a question posed by the audience at this point related to President Trump, his first term and tariffs, and what might have been learned as it concerned how the president managed those tariffs and why he puts them in place.
Oh, okay, everyone's looking down at me. University guy has maybe the least, you know, skin in the game of this. I can maybe take that one. So that is a real possibility. I think it depends on the sort of the mental framework that I have for this is the extent to which you believe that, you know, the tariffs are intended to be punitive and last a long time, and that they are indeed, you know, good, as the president has said many times, or whether you believe they're a negotiating tactic. And I think you look at some of the personnel that, you know, the president-elect has proposed to bring into his cabinet, who have said explicitly these are intended to be tactical and strategic and a negotiating tactic. And so that's why I think the sort of the way in which they get implemented, I think there will be some form of tariff implementation by the United States in 2025. I think there's no reason to believe that that's not going to be the case. It's the extent to which how widespread are they and the very specifics of how they get implemented.
I have a follow-up question because when you mention how long term, 6 years and running right now, right?
Yeah, although, I mean,
we're 6 years in running.
We're in this situation where, I mean, we're still doing a tremendous amount of soybean export business to China and other places, in part because of, again, how these tariffs have been implemented and when they get imposed and who gets exemptions to them, et cetera. All of that to say, if you have a crystal ball that knows how exactly this is going to play out, I think you are, you know, you're keeping your lips pretty tightly zipped at this point. Because I mean, most people aren't in that situation.
And the only thing that I would add is that I was kind of in your position in 2015, 2016. I thought there's no way, this is just talk, it's bluster. And it if there's anything that I learned from the previous go round, it's just take the man at his word and believe that he's going to do it, and prepare kind of for the worst case scenario in my mind, because I genuinely believe that the folks in the incoming administration they want to see this happen one way or another. And if it ends up being kind of a tactical, you know, trying to get some kind of deal, that's great. But if not, you know, it worked out okay last time. I'm not trying to be, you know, crude or rude or anything, but farmers, you know, the MFP payments and all that stuff, the farm economy did okay under the Trump administration.
It depends on how what you think okay is. Right? If you think being paid by the government is okay, that's fine.
Well, I think that, I mean, it's kind of like...
The follow-up question here is about the movement of the export market from the United States to Brazil.
And that's especially true in corn. And, you know, the corn business in Brazil to China now is huge. They changed their SPS regimen or their protocols, and now Brazil is a major supplier to that.
The audience here again turned back to a question we discussed earlier, which was the very dry conditions in which harvest took place and how that might show up in the January 10 USDA final crop production numbers.
I'll jump in and Matt can add on, but from an elevator perspective and a farmer perspective, we both have that. You're getting paid on 15-0 moisture corn. And when you have a GPS monitor in your combine and it's calculating your yield, it's on 15%. So when you get it in out of the bin, you may have heavier test weight. So there's a little counterbalance to that in my mind, because you're also paid on 56 pounds, and a lot of corn today is 60-plus. So maybe there's a little counter to that, but nevertheless, there's that phantom yield loss that you just don't get back. I kind of equate to the fact of beans. We're used to that, right, where you have beans coming out of the field at certain years 9, 10%, and you're paid on a standard of 13-0, right? So I think, in my opinion, the yields reported are based on 15% moisture, and only later on when you get to the end of emptying your bins out, do you recognize that there's a yield or a shrink adjustment you have to account for later on that could impact total stock, not just at your own individual farm, but overall, and maybe that's why we get those volatile surprises on quarterly stock reports.
Yeah, I think, I mean, I don't know if you remember this, Todd, when we were in Kansas City and I asked Lance Honig if I could ask him a question on air, and the question was, do they have a factor that allows for farmers lying about their bushels?
This was a couple of years ago. Lance Honig.
This has been a while.
Time was the...
Yeah.
Yeah, Lance Honig.
He said, yes, we do have a factor.
Yeah, they have
for
a lie
that.
Factor.
So,
yes,
so first of all, farmers, no offense, guys, are not considered to be the most honest people. But, you know, I'm with Brian. The bottom line is you're losing weight is what you're losing. And so, in essence, yes, you're selling bushels, but the less weight you have, the less bushels it turns out to be. So that's why, I mean, I'm not, Scott, we've talked about this, I'm not bullish, but I do think that there could be a little bit of a surprise in this January report. Now, what I would say is if we get a bullish surprise, so to speak, and maybe you get front month futures back to 450, or maybe we eclipse the 200-day, maybe, what should we be thinking about doing? it's not getting bullish. It's rewarding the market with a few sales. I was going to say something to Brian earlier. I know like ADM Decatur widened 6 cents this week. Did you guys widen about 6 cents as well? Mm-hmm. And so a lot of these folks have started to widen a little bit, which Brian knows there's corn that's coming, right? Mm-hmm. And it's going to be here soon. And so if I'm someone who's looking at the difference, like he said, 40 to 50, I've seen up to 60, the difference between a harvest low flat cash price and where we're at today, man, I'll tell you what, I think we need to pay attention here. You know, yes, we could get a bullish surprise in January, but what's the upside there? Without a major weather issue,
how much moved this week because the board rallied?
It was evidence in the basis.
It was evidence in the basis. The basis, the cash market always tells the story, right? Yeah. You know, it sends the signal. That's why, you know, maybe there's some adjustments on the export side. The other thing the cash market indicates, I meant to mention this earlier in my opening comments, but the Southeast, where we see a lot of our feed demand in the United States, had one of the smallest local corn crops it's had in the last 4 or 5 years. So that is one friendly component to corn demand that you could see pull forward as we go on. But to Matt's point, you have to move the corn when the market's telling you to move it, because seasonality in basis and when farmers are creatures of habit tend to move it January, February, March. That tends to be where the basis starts to weaken. And there's a reason why we stopped at that 200 day. Lots of hedge pressure, right? Producer's been waiting to sell. So we have to take advantage. Matt's absolutely right. We can't get bullish. We have to take advantage of rallies and sell into them.
I think we got to also remember what happened last year. You know, we held on and held on and held on. If we don't get a major weather issue, I think most of us probably up here would agree that we could see a repeat of last year. So you got to be pretty cautious as to snub your nose at a time when you factor in interest and you factor everything else in, holding on to this corn, there's a cost factor there. And it's plenty high right now with the price of money.
The next question from the audience concerned how to market the new crop or 2025 corn and soybeans.
So I'll start. Matt can jump in with his thoughts. I'm not a price fixer in 2025. Am I ultra bullish corn? No. I think there's a lot of demand unknowns, but I think the balance sheet and the world balance sheet, as Matt showed, is got a downtrend. So to me, what do I mean by that? Buy to put. Not price fixing, that's a great strategy. What's the cheapest put on the market? Your revenue crop insurance, right? Because it's subsidized by the government and it's revenue and not just price. It's yield and price. So to me, as we get into the month of February, it's crucial to use that as my baseline, know where my revenue floor is, and then you can utilize some sort of a put call strategy. What I mean, a min and a max, right? Correct. So you always, from an insurance perspective, not to get too deep in the weeds, but you know, you always have a scenario. If you don't add on an add-on product, you've got a 15% deductible. And typically speaking, ahead of time, before we know our crop insurance average, 15 to 20% is generally what we try and protect in our risk management strategies. That's really aligns with your deductible from an 85% RP policy. So if you're at a profitable level, remember, we're not price forecasting. We want to determine each individual grower should know what their costs are. And if we're at a point where APH, assuming we're going to grow APH, you can lock in a profit, then I would prefer to utilize a option strategy and not be price fixed today.
I think one thing we have to remember is from now until February, though, we don't have a fail safe. You know, I agree with Brian. And the unfortunate reality over the last couple of years, when we look at, for instance, this 23 crop and we look at the 24 crop, when we were all buying inputs, the price of corn was sufficient to make money. You had around $6 corn there in August of 22, and you had $5 plus corn in August of 23. And I'm not trying to Monday morning quarterback you. I'm just saying when the price of corn is high, I can assure you of one thing, the price of fertilizer is high too. That's all there is to it. And so I like to try to at least lock in some of that. I want to see how many bushels it takes for me to cover my input costs, you know. And so at this stage of the game, you know what the crop cost you to put in the ground. If I'm going to sell, and it's no offense to the elevator industry, he's got to carry this hedge all the way out. So you don't want to sell fall delivery, of course. Now you might do an HTA and then buy a call. It'd be a synthetic put. I'm okay with that. But if I'm going to buy a put and it's going to be an aggressive one, because let's face it, you know, 445 corn isn't a winner for anybody for the most part, unless you own your ground and it's paid for. And if you are, I don't know why you're here anyway. But and that's no offense to anybody. I'm just saying. But if you buy, like, for instance, an in-the-money 450 put, and maybe you sell a 380 put down there to help pay for it. Personally, if I'm buying crop insurance, I'm also okay selling like a 520 call. And why would I do that? Because if that right now, that strategy costs around 16, 17 cents. If the market rallies, I'm still above $5 after the cost of the trade on those bushels. Now, I only want to do about a quarter of my bushels. But that quarter of your bushel is going to pay you for your fertilizer. And so what that does is it gives me an in-the-money put. If the strategy costs me 16 cents and I'm 5 cents in the money, it's really only costing me 11 cents. And I've got 70 cents of downside protection. So that's what I would do to at least cover myself as far as what I've got invested in this crop.
Other questions? Yes.
Going back to the exports a little bit.
This question was related to the domestic crush of soybeans, which had been very good in the past year, and then looking forward what that usage might be, particularly as it's related to biofuels policy from the federal government.
It depends. I think a lot of it depends on the 45Z tax credit, and does the new administration support that? Do we get definition of the rules? There's been a lot of back and forth. I'll give a plug to Scott in his webinars the last 2 weeks. He's done a really good job kind of explaining those. Appreciate the insight from him. Certainly not an expert in that, but Joel can comment on his side. But I think there's a lot of uncertainty on the domestic use as well as the export side on oils.
Yeah, I don't have much to add, Mihan. I mean, if Scott wants to chime in, maybe we'll drag him into this. But I'd say the same thing. It depends on 45Z, and it's just the domestic piece is just so big on the bean oil demand side that.
I ask something? Because I said this in Commodity Week yesterday, and I still believe it is true, because he's on the WASI side, so World Ag Outlook Board. They only put existing policy into their WASD projections.
Yeah, I think talking to people at the World Board, including Mark Jekinowski, who's the chair, and I usually have him come talk to my commodity price analysis class every winter. I mean, they do have some degree of discretion, and they utilize that discretion because the alternative is producing sort of estimates that they know are wrong. So they do their best.
Why did they drop season's average cash price? Did you ask him that question by 40 cents for soybeans?
To reflect reality.
60 cents to reflect reality.
When you bring up season average cash price, if you looked at this December report, guys, you know, they dropped carryout 200 million and they kept the same season average
at
cash 410, price.
Yeah.
What's that tell you? You know, but going back to soybean oil, if you look, when did the soybean oil market top out at $48? It's basically whenever they made the announcement in California. You know, we're only going to do 20% seed oils. And so Malaysia, Indonesia had off palm oil crops last year. But the bottom line is, if we're not using this to make fuel, it's a major headwind.
Our conversation today was recorded December the 13th at the iHotel during the Farm Assets Conference. You just heard from Matt Bennett from AgMarket.net. He was joined on stage by Brian Stark at the Andersons, Colin Waters of the Illinois Corn Growers Association, and Joe Jansen from the FarmDoc team at the University of Illinois. I'm Extension's Todd Gleason.